Hey, who's this? Oh, I'm Vermont Edition producer Andrea Lorien. I'm usually behind the scenes, but I'm here to tell you that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Hope you enjoy it. Thanks.
It is a little chilly today here in Vermont, but hot summer days will, I hear, be here soon. And along with that will come pitchers of iced lemonade, creamies, and other cold treats. It's easy to take ice for granted when it's always available, but that has not always been the case. Environmental writer and historian Amy Brady dives into the cultural history of ice in the United States in her new book, Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. Vermont Edition producer Andrea Lorien recently spoke with Amy Brady from her home in Connecticut. Let's take a listen.
So you're an environmental writer and a historian, but I have to ask the question that first came to mind when I saw your book. Why ice?
It's a great question. It's one that I get often. The reason is because, you know, I personally am obsessed with ice. I love an icy glass of tea or water, especially on a hot summer day. And most people I know here in the United States feel similarly. They want ice in their drinks. They love ice cream. They like being in air conditioning in the summer. And what is interesting to me is that if you go almost anywhere else in the world, that's not the case. Americans are uniquely obsessed with ice and with feeling cool in a temperature sense. And I couldn't find a good answer for why that is. So I did the research myself, and this book, I think, offers a pretty fascinating answer.
So hearing the descriptions of life before ice was really fascinating.
Oh, and bewildering, the thought that you couldn't get cool no matter how hot things got or no matter how sick you got. You know, that's the other thing, that life before ice, if you were ill and running a fever, there was no effective way to get cool.
That's so wild to think about. So I have to ask about Frederick Ice King Tudor. I mean, he was really a character. Can you tell us about his role in popularizing ice in the United States?
I think that America's obsession with ice is a direct link to Frederick Tudor. So Frederick was born and grew up in eastern Massachusetts, so a New Englander, to a very wealthy family. And that's important because he was born in the late 1700s. And at that time, only wealthy people, even those living in the north where ice formed naturally on lakes and rivers, only they had access to ice year round because they had land. And on land, you could build ice houses, which were these contraptions that people who harvested ice out of lakes and rivers could store blocks of ice year-round, and they would stay there without melting. So in his early 20s, Frederick landed on the idea that if he could figure out how to ship those blocks of ice out of his family ice house to people living in warm climates around the world, he can make a killing, because who could tell, you know, how much people would pay for comfort and a sense of cool. And it took a lot of trial and error, but eventually he figured out how to do it, sparking an appetite for ice throughout the tropics and then eventually the American southern states and territories.
And you wrote in your book about how the ice in Maine in their remote lakes was really highly prized for its purity. Could the same be said for Vermont or other remote parts of New England?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Maine and Vermont both played very important roles in the early days of the ice trade. You see, Frederick launched the ice trade in about 1806, but it didn't really catch on in the United States until around the 1840s, 1850s. And that time period coincides with the peak of the Industrial Revolution, which for, you know, any history major out there will tell you, this was a filthy, filthy time in American history. You know, when factories and factory farms were just letting loose their detritus into the nearby rivers and lakes that flowed by their factories. And so the bodies of water that ice was being harvested out of, particularly around New York City, Philadelphia, Chicago, it was undrinkable. It was unfit for human consumption. So the only way that those ice companies could stay in business is if they moved their their businesses to more remote areas in places like Maine and certainly in Vermont.
In your book, there's sections on food and there's sections on sport and the different ways that ice touches our lives. And I wanted to talk a bit about ice skating because you had mentioned the mid-1800s and it became a really popular activity at the time. I would love to hear in what ways ice skating shifted the attitudes when it came to gender and social class.
Yeah. Ice skating in the United States was one of the most popular pastimes in the country. I mean, forget baseball. It was all about ice skating, especially in the early days in the northern states where ice formed naturally. People would skate as soon as the first ice that could support human weight would form, and this was really important to evolving social norms, because throughout the 19th century, Americans held a very, shall we say, Victorian era conservative view of courtship. And so there weren't many places that young couples could go beyond the watchful eye of a guardian who was always tasked to be close, lest the young lovers attempt to do something inappropriate. But what they could do is that they could get lost in the crowd on a skating rink. And so it became very, very popular among young people in particular. And because so many women were participating in this sport, they had to hike up their skirts so that they wouldn't trip on their lengthy Victorian era hemlines. And so skating played an important role in shaping women's fashion and making it more publicly acceptable for women to show off their ankles and their knees.
And to look at an ice skating rink, the ice all looks the same, but different ice sports require different ice. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this came as a big surprise to me as someone who did not know a lot about ice sports before writing this book. I just assumed that it was all the same, but it's not by any means. One of the most startling differences is the ice that the curling matches are played on. I always assumed that ice was kept as smooth as possible so that skaters could glide across the ice and either perform their twirls and their spins if it's ice skating, or to more effectively hit the puck if it's ice hockey. But curling requires a pebbling technique, which includes the act of spraying a flat surface of ice with water and then allowing those beads to freeze so that there's this pebbling effect over the entire sheet. And what's interesting is that scientists to this day, in 2024, don't actually know why curling, the sport of curling, works the way that it does. When a participant throws what's called the rock or the stone down the ice sheet, and they add a spin to it, which is where the term curling comes into play, the rock curls in the direction in which the hand moved rather than the opposite direction, which is how every other object on Earth reacts when it's being glided across the surface. And scientists really don't know why that is, but many of them think it has something to do with the pebbling of the ice on which the sport is played.
What was one of the most surprising things you learned in your research?
I was most surprised at how Americans reacted to the development of mechanically made ice. Here I am in 2024 enjoying a large glass of iced tea filled with ice that I took from the mechanical, automatic ice maker in my refrigerator. I think it's a wonderful thing. But when mechanical ice was first discovered and announced to the public in the 1850s, the public responded with cries of blasphemy, saying, "How dare a mere man create ice? Only God can create ice." And it took another 10 to 15 years post-development of this machine before the American public agreed to accept it and use mechanically made ice in their everyday lives.
There was a stat in your book that really kind of blew me away. In the 2020s, at least one in four Americans owned at least two refrigerators. And when I think about it, I'm like, how many people I know have a fridge in their basement, in their garage? Can you tell me about the ways that refrigeration and ice, how that is contributing to global warming?
Absolutely. So one of the most notable legacies of the ice industry is the rise of electric refrigeration. Just as Americans quickly adopted ice boxes into their homes in the late 19th century, Americans very quickly adopted electric refrigeration because it was so much more reliable than ice boxes, and it kept your food much colder. And in many ways, electric refrigeration has been a huge benefit, and it still is a huge benefit to our lives. And our lives would look much different if it didn't exist. At the same time, the popularization of this technology means that now there are approximately 110 million electric refrigerators in operation in this country alone. Wow. And wow. Most of those refrigerators are the biggest energy draw of any appliance in any average American home. Collectively, you know, worldwide, refrigerators and the cooling industry at large contribute more carbon to the atmosphere than the airline industry, which was shocking to me.
Wow. Wait, what? More carbon than the airline industry?
Globally speaking. Yeah, that's right. And here's the other wild fact. If the refrigerator has an automatic ice maker in it, like mine does, then it draws even more energy because most of these ice makers never shut off. That's why you can get ice any time of day or night. I would never say Americans or anyone need to give up their ice, but this book did lead me to think, you know, are there folks out there who are trying to find a solution to this problem so that we can have our ice and, you know, and use it too. And the answer is, yeah, I mean, this is a problem that, you know, engineers have been wrestling with for some time. And there are many kinds of technologies that are currently in development that draw far less energy than the conventional refrigerator most of us use today. In addition, there are models of refrigerators being developed that also issue conventional refrigerants, which are the gases that our refrigerators use to maintain their coldness, their cold temperature. These gases also, when the refrigerator starts to reach the end of its life cycle, they tend to seep out and, you know, also contribute to the greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. And so if we got rid of those as well, you know, we could see a dramatic reduction in the impact that refrigerators are having on climate change. And from the experts that I spoke to and quote in my book, that time is coming very, very soon, that switchover.
That was the author Amy Brady speaking about her book, Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. She discussed it recently with Vermont Edition producer Andrea Lorien.